Would you open up in your Bibles with me to Daniel chapter 11, our text for today, Daniel chapter 11. If you need a Bible, you can use those provided there in the seat backs. You'll find this morning's passage on page 748, page 748, Daniel chapter 11. Now, rather than read straight through the whole chapter, as sometimes we do, we're going to cover this chapter as we go, bit by bit, and you will see why in a moment. But as you're turning there, let me remind you that last week, passage left us a bit on a cliffhanger. And if you remember in Daniel chapter 10, Daniel was visited by a terrifying angel. And this angel not only terrifies him, but then comforts him and readies him to receive a prophecy that will last from chapters 11 all the way through chapter 12. So he receives this message from this angel, chapter 10, and then we get the message itself in chapters 11 and 12, a message about the future of God's people from Daniel's vantage point. And it's a message that includes quite a bit of trials, suffering, pain, persecution in store for God's people. This morning, we're going to dive into that message, especially as we zoom in here on chapter 11. So with your Bibles open, then let me start with a question about history. Let me ask you this. How do you think about the unfolding course of history? Is history just an unguided sequence of random events? Novelist Joseph Heller once described history as, quote, a trash bag of random coincidences torn open in the wind. How depressing is that? And yet this is how many people in our postmodern world view history. History is totally arbitrary, completely purposeless. The biblical understanding of time and history, however, is very different from that. According to the Bible, all of history is guided, governed, and ordained by the sovereign Lord of history, God Himself. And if the Bible's perspective on history is correct, that means that you and I should marvel. We should marvel at the magnificence of our God. Marvel at the magnificence of our God. Our passage today, I believe, teaches us to marvel at God for three reasons. First, we should marvel at the predictive accuracy of God. Marvel at the predictive accuracy of God. In verses 1 through 20, Daniel hears this message from the angel that allows him to look down the corridor of time. And from his perspective, Daniel is going to hear about the clash of kings. And he's going to hear this prophecy with great accuracy. Let's take a look at it. We're going to kind of walk through the details here. Look at verse 1. It starts out, the voice of the angel here says to Daniel, "And as for me," that's the angel speaking, "in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." Okay, that's the year when Darius the Mede, the Persian, took over the Babylonians. And so this verse here is showing us that behind the change of empires from Babylon over to Persia, there stands powerful angels and spiritual warfare, okay? Next, the angel goes on to tell Daniel about a future transfer of power from Persia over to the next empire, that is Greece. Look there with me, verse 2. "And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. And then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these." Friends, I want you to see that these angels' words that we just read in these verses Everything the angel just said right there comes to fulfillment in real history. See, the fourth Persian king following Cyrus the Great is Xerxes the First. Xerxes the First is indeed wealthy and great, and he provokes Greece, just as verse 2 predicts. Several years later, the king in verse 3 arises. You know him. His name is Alexander the Great. He conquers the known world. And then Alexander's kingdom goes not to his posterity, not to his sons, but it is divided up among his four generals, just like verse 4 describes. We hurry on. I want you to see, okay, the next several verses, this is going to be very detailed, very gritty. I encourage you, don't take notes, okay? Just keep one eye on the text and listen as I try to describe what's being prophesied here by this angel and how it gets connected to real history, how it gets fulfilled in real history. You'll notice that two of the four kingdoms that come from Alexander, two of those four kingdoms become especially important for Israel in this text as we move forward. In verse 5 and following, you will see the kings of the south. They refer to the Ptolemies based down in Egypt. And then we will read of the kings of the north. And these are a series of kings known as the Seleucids that are based up north in Syria. And between these two, the kings of the south and the kings of the north, lies God's people in the land of Israel. Okay, so let's just kind of work our way through it. Look with me. Notice verse 5. It says there, then, again, the words of the angel, then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. Okay, the king of the south there in that verse, it turns out in history, is actually Ptolemy the First. And one of his generals becomes the first king of the north, known as Seleucus the First, just like verse 5 predicts. Next, we read about the politics between these two kingdoms in the south and the north. Look at verse 6. After some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her and he who supported her in those times. Look, all of this came to fulfillment, everything I just read. By this time, about 250 BC, the king of the south is Ptolemy II. He tries to make an alliance with the king of the north, who is now Antiochus II. And Ptolemy, in order to make this alliance, offers his daughter, Bernice, to the northern king, offers her in marriage. But the deal breaks down when Antiochus's first wife poisons him, Bernice, and her son. The roller coaster is just starting here, people. Again, don't take notes, just take it all in. Next, we read that someone from Bernice's family arises in the south and attacks the north. Look at verse 7. And from a branch from her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. Okay, these verses that we just read, in these verses, Ptolemy the Third comes up from the south and attacks Seleucus the Second, who is now the king of the north. Ptolemy prevails, takes spoils of war, returns to Egypt. Then Seleucus unsuccessfully counterattacks. Then Seleucus has two sons who carry on this seemingly endless conflict. Look at verse 10. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north, and he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. All right, clear as mud at this point? All right, here's the thing. In these verses that I just read, here's what happens. These verses actually describe the rise of Antiochus III, otherwise known as Antiochus the Great, who campaigns against the south, but then Ptolemy IV, who is now the king of the south, attacks Antiochus to the north, and in 217 BC, he routs thousands of troops in the Battle of Raphia. And then Antiochus III makes a comeback, drives Egyptian forces back, defeating Ptolemy V in 200 BC. Everybody got that, right? Okay. Next, bear with me. Next, we read of an uprising in Egypt against the king of the south. It includes some of the Jews, some of God's people. Look at verse 14. In those times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then we read that Antiochus III attacks from the north, laying siege to the city of Sidon. Verse 15, then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. And then what happens next is absolutely fascinating. Here's what we're going to read. Antiochus III continues his advance through the land of Israel toward the south, but rather than continue and attack Egypt, he offers his daughter Cleopatra to the king of the south, Ptolemy V, thinking that she will be a spy, but it turns out Cleopatra is loyal to her new husband. And so we read verse 16, but he who comes against him shall do so as he wills, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them, and he shall give them the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Next, we see the end of Antiochus III. Bear with me, verses 18 and 19. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Listen, friends, exactly as predicted in those verses that I just read, Antiochus III ends up capturing some Mediterranean coastlands, but then he's rebuffed by the Romans, and he retreats, and he ends up dying by the hands of a mob while raiding a temple of Zeus. And then one of Antiochus III's sons will try to pay off the Romans and the debt that he owes to the Romans by robbing the Jerusalem temple, but he ends up being poisoned by his finance minister. Verse 20, then he shall arise in his place, one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. Okay, let's stop right there, and you say to yourself, why in the world, Pastor Eric, are you walking us through all of those details? I need to catch my breath, you say. And I do too. Thank you very much. Here's what I want to do. I want us to zoom out from the trees and look at the forest for just a moment and what was just read. If you're a bit dizzy after that tour, that whirlwind of a tour through those verses and that prophecy, don't worry. I want to show you the big picture. On the screen is a chart showing you all of the kings of the south, that is the Ptolemies, and all the kings of the north, that is the Seleucids. These are the two lines of kings that were just mentioned in the prophecy so far, from verse 5 all the way to verse 20. Now look, maybe you ask, why would Daniel care so much about this prophecy involving these two dynasties in this specific region of the world. Weren't there other important things going on in the world at this time? Why focus here? Here's why. Listen closely. Remember that the Ptolemaic dynasty is based down in Egypt. Can you picture it in the map? Those are the kings of the south, the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt to the south. The Seleucid dynasty is based in Syria to the north. What's right between these two kingdoms? Israel, Judah, Jerusalem, God's people. The theater of battle between all these kings takes place right there in and around the land of Israel. And Israel changes hands number of times in this prophecy as it unfolds. And God's people are swept up in the crossfire of all of these kings. Do you see that? So Daniel would be not only attentive to this prophecy, he would be riveted by this prophecy because God's people are right in the middle of the action. And I think, friends, that Daniel would also marvel at the specificity of this prophecy. And think about it. This angel just predicts the rise and fall of several empires and kings, as well as attacks and counterattacks and political alliances and betrayals and assassinations and more. And so I ask you, what kind of God can predict the future with this much detail? Daniel would be fascinated by this. We should be too. Today, you and I should marvel at God's predictive accuracy in this text even more than Daniel did. You say, why would we marvel even more than Daniel? Here's why. Think about it. You and I stand after the fact looking back at the fulfillment of everything that was said by that angel. As the chart on the screen makes clear, and as I've been saying, you can actually map this angel's prophecy onto the course of real history, and you can see that all of these words came about with impeccable accuracy. In fact, many theologically skeptical scholars conclude this prophecy is so accurate, it maps so clearly onto real historical events that it can't possibly be a real prophecy, they say. It must be a fake. It must be that somebody writing in the mid-second century BC must have looked at all that history and then wrote it all down to appear like a prophecy, but it must be fake. It's just too accurate. Friends, sadly, these scholars missed the whole jaw-dropping impact of this passage. Daniel receives this vision in 536 BC, and it predicts specific events going all the way to the mid-second century BC, events that we can verify in the record books. So look, if you're not a Christian today, please take note of this passage. I would urge you. This passage is another piece of evidence that the God of the Bible is incredibly powerful, and his words always come true. If you are a Christian this morning, to most of us today, this passage should make us marvel at the predictive accuracy of our God. He not only knows the future and can predict what will happen, he also governs all of history and ordains what will be. Here's how God himself puts this in Isaiah chapter 46, verses 9 through 10. God says, I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose. Through this prophecy, Daniel looks down the corridor of time. And what does he see? He sees great turmoil for the people of God. As I said, they are caught up in the crossfire between two warring empires to the north and to the south. And yet at the same time, Daniel also sees a God who predicted all of this from the start. He sees a God who is completely in control and never surprised. And friends, when you know that God, that kind of God, you can face the future without fear. Like Daniel, you can face the future without fear. Even when you don't know where the future is going, you know that God knows where the future is going, and therefore you can trust him. It reminds me of a recent journey I was on, a trip to Peru with our Christ Community Church missionaries, Doris and Lambert Anderson. We stayed overnight in a certain Peruvian city, and the next day we were going to get up and drive to another airport where we would get on a smaller plane, fly into the Amazon jungles to visit the Tucuna people. So here's how things went down, all right? We wake up at this hotel and we're told by the Andersons that they're gonna go on ahead of us to the airport, and they instructed the rest of us to follow in a taxi that they had pre-arranged, all right? They already paid the taxi driver, already apparently told him where we're headed, and all we had to do was just get in this car when it pulls up to the curb. So sure enough, this taxi just pulls up to the curb. This guy begins to load our luggage. We don't even really exchange words. We just get into the taxi, and before you know it, he speeds off, and there we go, bobbing and weaving and winding through this bustling foreign city. And suddenly I think to myself, well, I have no idea where we're going. I'm in this foreign place, weaving through all these streets, and I can't even speak the guy's language. For all I know, he could turn down a dark alley, rob us, and kill us, right? But then a second thought came to mind. I remembered, even though I'm thinking to myself, I have no idea where I'm going, I can relax because this driver knows where we're going and the Andersons trust him. Therefore, I can trust him to take us where we need to go. Brothers and sisters, from our finite human perspective, we don't always know what the future holds. We don't always know where we're going. But listen, we do know the driver. He's the sovereign Lord of history. He knows where things are going. And we can trust him. We can trust him to drive. And we should marvel at the predictive accuracy of our God. That's the first thing. Secondly, we should also marvel at the comprehensive sovereignty of God. The comprehensive sovereignty of God. Now in verses 21 through 35, a truly evil supervillain comes onto the scene. He is the Seleucid king Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who rules from 175 to 164 BC. Remember him? We talked about him back in Daniel chapter 8. Where Daniel already has predicted this guy's brutal reign. Well, here we see it again. Let's read these verses together, beginning in verse 21. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him, and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his fathers' fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up an abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. Friends, just look at how that passage I just read, look at how it describes in detail the evil life and times of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. You'll notice verse 21 recounts how Antiochus comes to the throne through political manipulation. Verses 22 through 24 tell about his powerful rise. Everyone who resists him is swept away, we're told, including the Jewish high priest, who we know is Ananias the Third, referred to here as the Prince of the Covenant. We know that Antiochus ends up selling the Jewish high priesthood to the highest bidder. And he makes alliances with some of the Jews who go along with his policies of trying to force the Jews to adhere to Greek religion and practice. Verses 25 through 28 describe Antiochus's campaign, his first campaign into Egypt against the king of the south, who would be Ptolemy the Sixth. He ends up going down, plundering Egypt, and on his way back up to Syria in 169 BC, he squashes a rebellion in Jerusalem, plunders the Jerusalem temple, and massacres thousands of Jews before returning home up north. Then in verse 29 through 30, it describes a second campaign by Antiochus down into Egypt in 168 BC. But that campaign down into Egypt failed. Antiochus is rebuffed by the kings of the south, who are assisted by the Romans. And the Romans are actually mentioned there. They're called the ships of Kittim in verse 30. Antiochus is humiliated and enraged by this defeat. And so on his way back up home, he goes through Israel and he takes out his rage on Judea. And he carries out a severe persecution that lasts from 167 to 164 BC. He halts the Jewish temple sacrifices. He sets up a sacred object to Zeus in the Jewish temple. He sacrifices a pig on the altar. This is what is known here as an abomination that makes desolate. See that phrase in verse 31? He forces Jews and all the surrounding cities to sacrifice to pagan gods. He burns Torah scrolls. He prohibits Jewish Sabbath and circumcision. And anyone caught resisting would be killed. It was truly a massacre. Verses 32 through 35 predict the mixed reaction to Antiochus. Some of the Jews were seduced by him. Others stood firm, even to death. God's people were refined. They were purified by this suffering. We're told also that there was a definite end point to this persecution under Antiochus. You see that in verse 37, where we read about the time of the end. That is the time of the end of all of this suffering. Look, as you know, the Jewish Maccabees would in fact lead a revolt, take back Jerusalem, cleanse the temple, and restart the sacrifices in December of 164 BC. And this Maccabean victory is celebrated today during the festival of Hanukkah. Now, again, zoom out and think with me for just a moment. If you are Daniel and you're receiving this prophecy, everything we've just described would be horrifying to hear. Unthinkable, right? We know that for the Jews, these atrocities under Antiochus IV, they would become one of the darkest chapters in all of Jewish history. And yet, there is a silver lining in the text at this point. There's a silver lining there. Did you notice that all along the way, as I read the section, we keep reading of the mysterious, providential hand of God? For instance, there in verse 24, it says that the conquests of Antiochus will last only for a time, the text tells us. In verse 27, the plans of the wicked kings are thwarted because the end is yet to be at the appointed time, we're told. In verse 29, Antiochus returns to attack Egypt again at the appointed time. In verse 35, the end of the suffering for God's people, we're told, awaits the appointed time. That sound like a broken record? It awaits the appointed time. These phrases all throughout this prophecy are like clues. They're like clues that even evil thugs like Antiochus are operating by permission from God. God's sovereignty, friends, is so comprehensive that even Satan, even Antiochus, and every other tyrant down through the ages, all of them are actually advancing God's overarching purposes, whether they realize it or not. They are on God's leash. They may go no further than God allows. I remember when I growing up, I had a little floppy dog that had one of those leashes that would wind up inside of the handle. So attach the dog to the thing, right? And you're holding the handle, and the dog could walk out and it would unwind the leash as far as it would go. But at a certain point, you just hit the button to lock the leash and that little doggy may not go any further, right? Some of you probably still have one of those little dog leashes. Well, listen, God has every tyrant on a leash like that. Every persecutor of God's people can only go as far as the Lord of history permits. And they may go no further. Brothers and sisters, this is hard to comprehend, but I believe this is true based on the evidence of Scripture. That even sin and accidents and cancer and suffering and Satan himself need a permission slip from God to do anything. And though God is never directly responsible for evil and sin, God does use evil things and sinful people to somehow accomplish his good purposes in our lives and in the world. And so Daniel looks at this prophecy of horrific suffering under the hand of Antiochus Epiphanes, and even here he sees God's comprehensive sovereignty at work. Even here. And you and I need to see the suffering in our lives the very same way. We should marvel that God is somehow allowing and leveraging even the most difficult things in our lives for his good purposes. In the Bible, we see this most clearly at the cross, don't we? In the darkest hour, when it seems like all was lost, and sinful men had done their worst, even there, God was still in control at the cross. And the Apostle Peter preached about the cross, saying this in Acts 2:23. He said, "This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." Or then in Acts chapter 4, verses 27 through 28, the early Christians, they prayed to God, saying, "In this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." Wow. See, at the cross, man carried out his worst, and yet somehow, God was accomplishing his very best for our redemption. So then what are we saying here, theologically? What are we saying? Well, we're saying that God is never directly responsible for evil and sin, But God can ordain, allow, and use evil and sin as a means to accomplish his good purposes. He is that comprehensively in control, and we should trust him. Even when we don't understand how God is using our pain for his glory and our good, even so, we should trust him. It reminds me of when my kids were really little and they needed to go into the doctor to get their immunization shots. I mean, my kids, little, like little toddlers, right? And you bring them into the doctor and there's that horrifying moment as a dad where I literally had to wrap my arms around my child to hold them in place so this scary doctor can come and poke them with a needle, right? From the kids, the little kids' vantage point, this is terrifying. They don't understand what's going on. They're just going through suffering. Like, what's that guy doing with that needle? As their dad, with my arms wrapped around them, I have a different vantage point. I know this shot is for their good, for their protection. They can't understand that. But at some level, they have to trust me. They have to trust me. Friends, do you believe that God is good even when he allows painful things into your life and you don't understand them? No matter how hard you try, you don't understand why. But do you believe that even at those points of greatest pain in your life, those points of pain are only there by permission from God? And somehow he is using even those painful things for his glory and for your good. Are you starting to marvel at this God? This text should make us marvel. We should marvel at the predictive accuracy of God. We should marvel at the comprehensive sovereignty of God. But then finally, we should also marvel at the unstoppable victory of God in this text. At this point in the angel's prophecy, right here at verse 36 and to the end, the language of the prophecy takes an unexpected, mysterious turn. We've just been speaking about Antiochus IV Epiphanes, but now there seems to be a sort of seamless transition to an unnamed evil king far greater than Antiochus ever was. Check it out, beginning in verse 36. Follow along as I read through to the end. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortress instead of these. A God whom his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign God. Those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many and shall divide the land for a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, with many ships. And he shall come into the countries and shall overflow and pass through, and he shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall. But these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main parts of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and of silver and of all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction, and he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. You won't be surprised to know that there's a great deal of debate about the king's identity in these verses from verse 36 to the end of the chapter. Some people think that the angel's prophecy continues to be about Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. I think that's a reasonable view in light of the context. After all, that's the guy we've been talking about at that point in the text, right? And Antiochus did blaspheme the one true God of Israel and deify himself, as verse 36 describes. Antiochus' nickname, after all, was Epiphanes. Remember? That nickname means God manifest. Notice, Antiochus also paid no attention to the gods of his father. We're told in verse 37, the real Antiochus did this by abandoning Apollo for Zeus. He certainly did devote many to destruction, and we read that he pitched his palatial tents in Israel, according to verses 44 through 45. So there's a lot in here that might lead us to believe, and if you hold this view, that's fine. Perhaps this is, in fact, continuing to describe Antiochus Epiphanes. However, there are some other clues or evidences in the text that make us realize that perhaps someone greater is being described. For instance, Antiochus never conquered the Egyptians to the degree that is suggested in this text in verse 43. No, he was humiliated by the Egyptians and the Romans. Antiochus didn't die in Israel near the glorious holy mountain, like it says in verse 45. No, he actually died of some disease while on a minor campaign out in Persia. Furthermore, as we will see in chapter 12, we'll see this next week, the vision goes on to describe the end times bodily resurrection from the dead. And therefore, this king at the end of this chapter appears to be someone who is reigning at the very end of history. All the language describing his worship of self, his deification of war, his overwhelming assault and destruction and blasphemy leads me and many others to believe that this king at this point is describing a final opponent of God's people at the end of the age. Think of it like this. It's like when we get to these verses, we see Antiochus Epiphanes 2.0. Someone greater that he points to. We saw this same figure back in Daniel chapter 7. Do you remember? He's the boastful little horn who is put down by the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man when he comes to establish and consummate his kingdom forever. Well, here this guy is again. Now, you be the judge, because it could go either way, but I would suggest to you that this mysterious king here at the end of the chapter appears to be the so-called man of lawlessness that the Apostle Paul describes with very similar language in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He appears to be the so-called anti-Christ figure mentioned in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18. Or we might say he's the final beast from the book of Revelation chapter 19, the very beast who is routed by Christ when he returns, the very beast who is thrown into the lake of fire. From where we sit today, this figure then would be still in our future. That might sound a little terrifying, but don't miss the hope in this vision. Don't miss it. Even this supervillain cannot stop the triumph of God and his true Christ. Look at how he ends. After all that wrath, all that blasphemy, all that destruction, all that fury, we read there in verse 45, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. Thank you very much. Sit down. Drop the mic. Like, it reminds me of chapter 7. Remember when the little horn is just yapping away like Beaker from the Muppets? Me, 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 me. And suddenly he's just killed and his body is burned. What's the point? Here's the point. Here's the point for Daniel. Here's the point for us. Nothing and no one can stop the victory of our God. No measly antichrist can stop the true Christ from consummating his kingdom forever. And friends, that is really good news. Thank you for that. That is really good news if you are on the side of this God and of his Christ. That's good news that gives you courage, like Daniel, to get out of bed every day and face every evil challenge that comes your way. Friends, all of this is good news that should make us marvel, right? We should marvel. Marvel at our future predicting God. Marvel at our totally sovereign God. Marvel at our unstoppable, unflappable, all-powerful God. He is Lord of history. Amen. And you should make sure, thank you, and you should make sure he is Lord of your life. Why? Because here's the thing. If he is Lord of your life, that means you can look right at the future and you can laugh come what may. Because you know the one who holds all of history in his hands. Can you look at the future and laugh? Because you know the Lord of history.